good to be with you all this morning and talk about a somewhat arcane-sounding subject, computer viruses, artificial life, and the origin of life. What do we mean when we talk about computer viruses? The name was derived from biological viruses. If you're familiar with biological viruses, you've certainly experienced plenty of them by this time. They are a type of thing we might even call sublife of some sort. It can't operate by itself, but where there are existing living cells, viruses are set up in some way, we'll say programmed, to be able to get inside that cell and to subvert its reproductive machinery so as to make copies of the virus instead of copies of the cell. And then they generally fill up the inside of the cell with these viruses and then break the membrane and then head off and infect other kinds of cells. Computer viruses are little computer programs that invade a computer and they take over its functions, usually hiding inside another program, and then they begin to do various sorts of things. So, computer viruses is one thing we'll be talking about this morning. Another thing we'll be talking about is artificial life. What is artificial life? Well, most of us by now have seen the Star Wars trilogy and we know about R2, D2, and whatever the other one is, 3PO is his surname anyway, that we think of as artificial life, but we're talking about something far more modest at this particular point. And when we talk about artificial life, we're talking about attempts to mimic life, especially reproduction, and attempts to do that typically on a computer. Already back in 1802, when Paley wrote his very famous work on design in nature, thing he pointed out is that although we think of a watch as something designed and a watchmaker as a designer, he said for living things, what you've got is sort of a watch that can make copies of itself. And so he was using in 1802 lingo what we now call self-reproducing automata, a machine of some sort that can make a copy of itself. A Xerox machine is not a machine that can make a copy of itself. It's a machine that can make a copy of a picture of itself, okay? We're talking about a machine that can reproduce itself. And you can see that that will boggle the imagination if you think about that on some kind of serious level. Some kind of machine that can go out and dig for iron ore and can find silicon and then can process all the stuff and such. You can see you're getting to something very big. We're not talking about anything quite that big. We're talking about something that inside a computer, a program that can somehow make another copy of itself in some way that new program will do the same kinds of things. So that's basically what artificial life is about. Attempts to mimic life, especially reproduction, and most of it has been done in the computer environment. Origin life is why the artificial life stuff is being done. There are attempts to find out how complicated life is, and most of the people who are in it are assured that it's not so complicated, if they can find the secret, that it could not have happened by itself in the history of our universe, that you don't need a god to do that thing. So origin of life studies are attempts to figure out how life got started in one way or another. And there's the whole question of whether it could have started naturalistically or not and such. So can we figure out how it got started? So we're going to jump in and we're going to talk about computer viruses. And then we're going to talk about artificial life and then just say a few words on the application of this to the origin of life. So, computer viruses. My discussion here follows that fairly closely of a very intriguing book that's been out a few years now by a fellow named Mark Ludwig. Mark Ludwig has a doctorate in physics, but he's involved in computer work primarily today. And he is the author of the first little black book of computer viruses, which lists the programs for how a lot of them work. And has not been well received by people who would like to keep the knowledge of how computer viruses work down to a minimum. But he got interested in the question then of how computer viruses relate to artificial life. And so he wrote this book that you see up there, Computer Viruses, Artificial Life, and Evolution. What we learn about computer viruses is that computer viruses are closer to artificial life than anything humans have ever made. Computer viruses can do lots of things that living things can do. They're able to reproduce. Okay? they are often designed to hide from predators, predators being your antivirus program on your computer. They are able to survive outside captivity. Most computer programs that have been designed to mimic life in one way or another, which we'll look at under artificial life, are very fragile programs. If they're put in a hostile environment, they pretty immediately crash, but the computer viruses typically do not. And then the computer viruses infect their hosts. They annoy the host owners. They sponge off of the computer's electricity, computer time, memory space, and various other things of that sort, and the more malicious ones destroy things. The slight poetic flavor to that last line is accidental, as far as I can tell. But infect, annoy, sponge, destroy. There we are. Well, what about computer viruses and their origins? Well, computer viruses were designed by intelligent creators. Some of us may be aggravated enough about computer viruses that we think that the guys don't have common sense or are malicious. I can grant that, I think, for some of them. But you've got to have a certain level of intelligence to be able to design a computer virus. So designed by intelligent creators. No one claims, no one I know of, claims that they arose spontaneously. I've not talked to everybody in the world, and there's some people out there with strange ideas, as we know. So there may be people who claim that they arose spontaneously, but not seen it. But it's a fair question to ask, how likely would it be for something as complex as a computer virus to arise by chance in the computer environment? Well, Ludwig was interested in that, and so he took $1,000 of his hard-earned money, and he held Ludwig's first international virus writing contest in 1993. And he sent this out on the internet and said basically, look, I'm offering $1,000 for the shortest, simplest virus that will be able to do certain things. And he listed what those were, and I don't have them down here for you, but devise the shortest virus possible given certain minimal functions. One of the functions was obviously that the virus would be able to reproduce itself. Two, would be able to do something inside the memory of its program. And three, that it would be able to copy itself in some way so that when you turn the computer off, you didn't kill the virus. Okay? You'd have to go looking for it and such. So Ludwig sent out a sample then with his contest rules. And then in the course of a year, all the applications came in. And he awarded a grand prize winner who got the $1,000 and several runners-up who got pats on the back over the internet or something of that sort. And he printed all of these. So in his book, Computer Viruses and the Origin of Artificial Life in the... Oh, yeah, got his title wrong here now. He can't go up with my own title. Computer Viruses, Artificial Life and Evolution. He prints those and then begins to discuss them. He points out that all of these programs, his sample, the grand prize winner, and the runners-up, were all over 100 bytes in length. I think he's talking about 8-bit bytes here, as best I can tell. So that basically is what we're looking at then. And so now he's going to begin to calculate how likely is it that in a computer environment, something like this would arise by chance. Shortest virus that has been proposed that will do these minimal functions is 101 bytes. If you take 101 bytes times 8 bits, you get 808, and 2 to the 808 would be the number of possible files of length 101, and when you convert that into tens, it's 10 to the 243 possible files of length 101. So, how long would it take to randomly hit one of those? Well, let's take all of the 100 million PC users in the world and have them run their machines full time and have them make only 101 byte files at the rate of 1,000 files per second. How long would it take to make what you need? Well, we've converted the probabilities. The probability that these 100 million PC users will hit the right file in the history of the universe is 4 times 10 to the minus 214. It is not likely that you are going to get a functional computer virus by that process. Well, hey, there are, of course, more than 100 million things out there doing things in the organic world, so maybe we could crank it up some. Suppose we take each of the elementary particles in the universe and turn them into a PC user with a PC and have them running their machines full-time, making only 101 byte files at 1,000 bytes a second. What's the probability then? Well, it rises to 6 times 10 to the minus 100. So there's a 1 chance in 10 to the minus 99, a 1 chance in 10 to the 99, roughly, that will happen. Well, you see something there pretty quickly. It doesn't look likely that computer viruses form by chance, the simplest kinds that we can think of here. Well, Ludwig isn't finished with that. So he goes back and says, well, let's see, how about shorter viruses than the ones that qualify for the contest? Take one, for instance, that just copies itself on top of all the programs in memory, rather simpler than the specified conditions. He was able to find one of those that was only 42 bytes long. That would, if you hit all the elementary particles in the universe as PCs, et cetera, you'd certainly get something like that. Running for the history of the universe. But if you only had these 100 million PC users operating for the history of the universe, the chances are still 8 times 10 to the minus 72. Not very likely. Well, Ludwig moves down to something simpler than that, then, what he calls a pseudovirus. A pseudovirus is something that can make copies of itself, but it can't save the disk. So when the way you get rid of those viruses, you turn the computer off. Okay? Gone. Okay? So he's able to get one of those that's only 7 bytes long. Why is that? Because the copy command is kind of a built-in command in most computers, and that means the computer's doing all the work, and the program itself is not doing much. Well, with that one, if you have these 100 million PCs, you'll certainly get lots of those kind of programs out. But if you only got one PC, you're doing it yourself, and you're going to say, how much running time will I need on my computer to do this? You'll still need 2.5 million years. So what you're seeing here is something that applies immediately to the biological question of the origin of life as well. And that is, one, self-reproduction is not simple. Two, relatively simple things won't form randomly in the probabilistic resource of the universe. A universe as big as ours is, a universe as old as ours is, etc. And I have not found anybody that's come up with cosmologies yet that have our universe starting at a Big Bang 15 billion years ago, but some way for information to get into our universe from some other universe that's been around for 85 trillion years or something of that sort. So you're really stuck with the 15 billion years and the size of the universe and that sort of thing. Of course, there are people who will say, well, whenever that won't work, just postulate more universes. You know, if you've got 10 to the 100 universes, then maybe one of them might have something happen like this. Well, that's all right for one time, although that's still pretty speculative. But that gets kind of tired when you have to invoke that 2 or 3 times in the sequence of something leading to life or leading to the kind of life we've got. So that's kind of where we are there. We try to pull that together. Even very simple computer viruses are very complex from the perspective of random assembly. We can see why no one thinks computer viruses formed by accident. But maybe there's a way out. Maybe some other form of artificial life will show us how this could have happened. So we move from computer viruses, a special case of artificial life, over to the more generic question of artificial life. Now, interest in the question of artificial life got started in the computer age, right when the computer age got started. About 50 years ago, John von Neumann, one of the early designers of computers, he's the first guy to think of the idea of having a computer program that could be fed into the computer rather than having a built-in program of some sort. He is the one, I think he's even the inventor of flowcharts for all of that, was interested in designing a self-reproducing automaton. He knew that at bottom, that's kind of a minimalist definition of life. An automaton, something that can function on its own, that doesn't mean it doesn't need outside energy sources and things of that sort, but within some kind of environment where it can find those things, function on its own, and can make copies of itself that can do the same sort of thing. So he said, now, to try and simulate this in a biological environment, we're going to really get out of hand. We're talking 3 dimensions. We're talking all the strange shapes of molecules. We're talking about diffusions through liquids. We're talking about docking sites and all of those sorts of things. So he said, let's try something simple. Let's try and see if we can move it to a 2-dimensional environment and imagine something like computers at work. So he imagines that you have a rectangular array of computer chips. 50 years ago, they would probably have been boards with vacuum tubes in them, but get what we got here. And imagine a rectangular array of identical sort of general-purpose chips, each of them wired to their four neighbors. And what you're going to do is you're going to send a signal from one of these chips to another chip that will change its state. And some of these chips will be in just a quiescent state. They'll just be sitting there, not doing anything. Some of these states will be in a status that they're able to transmit information coming to them from one or two directions and send it off in the opposite direction, something of that sort. There'll be a data transmission kind of thing. And then various of the other computer chips will be a left-turn computer chip. The signal that comes in from this direction will be turned and go out, make a left turn and go out to the other chip and that sort of thing. And the idea then was that as the chips behave differently, I will try to design an array of them that their initial state is such that they will proceed to make a copy themselves in the quiescent chips nearby. So chips behave differently depending on which operational state each is in. And for our visualization purpose, we imagine they've got a little LCD display on the top, and they've got one or two or three or four or five or six or 29 or whatever, however many states you need, marked on the top on the LCD display saying, that's what state I'm currently in, and so you can tell what's going on. Now, von Neumann did not try to build this, okay? Big expense, all of those boards with the vacuum tubes in them and the wires and that sort of thing. But he said, we can mimic that on a computer. And so he began to design what these different things would be. And what he had in mind, oh, excuse me, here's a overhead that shows you what an array of these chips look like for you to understand that all these loose wires out here are headed off to other chips in different places. And this one is in state 4. You can't see where I'm pointing. But the upper left one's in the state 4, and the upper right one's in state 1, and a couple of 3-0 ones there in the middle line and such. And you would basically give definitions to what those numbers mean, and they're just indicating what the thing is capable of doing inside. Well, von Neumann then visualized that this is what it would be. You would have some kind of set of chips that would represent the constructing unit there. And what it would do is when the thing begins to operate, it will begin to change the status of the chips to its right and begin to make a constructing arm through which information will be transmitted. And then when that arm reaches out far enough to get clear of the other unit, it will then begin to construct a reproduction of this original unit. But besides the constructing unit part of the automaton, you need some kind of memory control that is going to access the information on how to make whatever it's making out there in the unit under construction. And it would get that information from a set of chips. The chips don't move, so it's got to pull the information in. But the instruction tape would be a set of chips that would be in various states containing information. And that information would gradually be pulled in to the memory control, transferred to the constructing unit, where it'd be processed and then sent out the constructing arm and begin to make this other sort of thing. And so von Neumann then asked himself, how do we build something like that? And he began to design a set of how many states there would be and what each state would do and how you change from one state to another and how you read an instruction tape and that sort of thing. And that's all got to be in these chips. And yet the chips need to be very generic, okay? They're all identical. And so he nearly got it finished before he died, and his associate finished it up, and it was then published under von Neumann's name. And basically, here's what you get. You get a memory control unit that was 300 by 500 chips. Okay? You get a constructing unit that was about the same size, but you get an enormous instruction tape, 150,000 chips. And the upshot of the whole thing is you have something about as complicated as a modern computer. Woo. So what began to appear from von Neumann's stuff is, this isn't going to happen by chance. But when people looked at that and thought about that, they said, well, hey, surely can make something simpler than this. For one thing, von Neumann's cellular automaton was designed to be able to construct any kind of cellular automaton, not just a copy of itself. And so if you could specialize the thing to something that would just make a copy of itself, because we as humans don't reproduce frogs or cows or horses or something, we just reproduce humans, you see. So, and he says that's characteristic of life. so we shouldn't go for the gold, something will reproduce anything, a universal constructor, we just go for a specialized constructor. And so a fellow named Codd worked on a more simplified version of it, and yes, it was simpler. He knocked down the 29 chip states to 8 chip states, I believe, and sought to put a still big unit like this. And then a fellow named Stephen Langton came along, and he made a breakthrough to a much more simple automaton. We call that the Langton automaton. He basically noticed that in Codd's automaton, there was a little structure that had information circulating around in it to keep it stored and safe, and then would put copies of it at one end, and was used for timing or something of that sort in Codd's automaton. And so basically what Langton did said, hey, I think I can modify this little component in such a way that it'll make a copy of itself. And after working around a good while, he did. And that was published in Physica D some years ago. And it's a little automaton that reproduces itself in 151 time steps. If we kind of visualize what this automaton looks like, so that we're looking kind of just at the numbers on the faces of the chips, it looks like that. And basically, what Langton has done here is the quiescent states on this picture are shown either by blanks or by zeros. By zeros if they're in the middle where you need to see them, and by blanks outside so that you don't clutter the picture. So you can see its basic shape. It looks a little bit like a Q. The twos are a sheath that protects the information. Okay, the information is inside in the form of a train of ones. So ones are information chain, but they're kind of the just sitting there and do nothing information chain, part of the chain. The zeros are a marker that will follow another signal. And then the sevens, he has designed so that when a seven hits a wall, like this one here at the bottom will do as it moves to the right, here we'll move over here and hit that two, it will change the two to a one, and then you will get a two added up here, and a two added up here, and a two down here. That is, it will extend the length of the arm one step. And so what he showed was that by having 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of those in a row, you could extend this arm by 6 steps. And then he devised a way in which you could make the arm turn left. And he did that by having a sequence of 2, 4 signals. You can see one here and one here. So the idea is then that when you start this machine, this stuff will be circulating around here, but it'll also be sending a copy out that arm. And when the 7 hits the end, it will extend that 1, and the next 7 will extend it 1, etc. And if you've extended it 6 times, then you'll run into the 4s, and the 2 4s will make it make a left turn. And then the arm will extend itself this way, 6 turns, 6 steps, and then the 4s will show up again, and it'll make a left turn. And then it'll extend itself back 6, which doesn't quite bring it back to this other thing, and it will turn left, and it'll come down here, and it'll finally hit down here and make another loop. And then you begin to see what the 5s and 6s are for, okay? And the 3s, for that matter. And they all come jumping out, and they begin to close off this arm and go up here and make a new arm at the top and make an arm that direction out on the other one. And I'm going to run all this on my computer here in a few minutes after the talk, but I'm just trying to walk you through it right now to see what it did. Well, that's very clever, and there was an article about it in Time magazine a year or so after the article came out in Physica, and a lot of hoopla was made about it because here is some kind of a self-reproducing automaton that really looks pretty simple. Actually, it turns out you can make simpler ones than this. I wrote an article on this Langton automaton in the Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation some years ago, and said, well, this looks like the simplest automaton anybody has built. Anybody got any suggestions for anything simpler? I showed that that this was not likely to happen by chance. And lo and behold, an evangelical fellow out of Trinity Western University in the math department cranked out a simpler one. His name is John Bile. And here's Bile's automaton. It's much harder to see what's going on in Bile's automaton, but here it is over here at time zero. And the twos around the outside shield the information on the inside. The information on the inside is just those 4 digits there, and they just wander around in circles like that and do funny things to what else is out there. And as that thing runs, it kind of just seems to mumble around, and finally you've got another one of the same kind over on the other side, 25 steps time steps further on, but I show you some of the intermediates here at 5, 10, 15, 20, and 25 time steps. And by the time you reach 25 time steps, you've got the place where this pattern here is exactly the same as the one at T0, but it's turned by 90 degrees. So the 5 and the 2 here correspond to the 5 and the 2 in the bottom there. And it's now going to make a copy up in that direction, and this thing will then make a copy out in this direction and such, and in that way doing the same kind of thing that Langton's automaton is going to do. Well, Ludwig found out about this somewhere or another. I think he must have seen the article in the ASA Journal or perhaps in Physica. So he devised a automaton that reproduces, and it is really simple, okay? It's a triangular-shaped automaton, and the twos are the shield, if you like. The information is the one. Say, that's information? Well, I didn't much information, I guarantee you, okay? And in just three time steps, it reproduces itself. That's the zero. Here's the first step. It produces a three. Then it does some other junk over here. And then at this point, this is already the reproduced one turned at 90 degrees, and this has a couple more steps to make the second copy. So it kind of turns itself, which is what the other ones do, and it makes another copy down here. So it reproduces in five steps to make a new one at a different location. So there they are. That one's certainly likely enough. That must happen by chance, huh? Well, let's work out some probabilities. The probability I worked out for the ASA Journal article on Langton's automaton with a number of very favorable assumptions for the thing was that the chance of something like this happening in the history of the universe was something like 1 in 10 to the minus 129. So you see that's back out where you are with Ludwig's computer viruses. When Biles' automaton was produced, he showed that using my assumptions, his automaton would occur very, very frequently. And I had to say in a response letter to the editor to the journal, well, I'm going to have to be stingy now and take back some of the simplifying assumptions I've given you because they're not realistic. And so to suggest something more realistic and with a little bit more realistic conclusions, Biles' automaton looks like it's only going to happen once in one chance in 10 to the 69 in the history of the universe. Still not likely. Well, Ludwig then came out with his automaton, and using Biles' assumption, it's certainly going to happen very frequently. You'll get one formed every 10 to the minus 14 seconds, or 10 to the minus 14 per second formed in the history, you know, during the universe's operation. And I said, okay, well, let's see if there are any other assumptions I made that are unrealistically such. And after messing around with that a little bit, it's still, I actually got it to be less probable than the ones I'd done with Bile, though in fact it's obviously far more probable, but just shows you that I had given away some stuff in the Bile and Langton calculations that shouldn't be given away. The last thing I did here was that Ludwig's automaton is in a sense mimicking a moderate-sized molecule, and you ask, what's the likelihood of having all of the carbon or whatever in the universe in that particular form, having that many of those, and it really shoot it down pretty badly. What you do see is that you can go to simpler and simpler automata, but the ones you're getting to are depending more and more upon some hidden things, the transition rules that tell you how to change from one number to another. And those are something that do not exist in the universe per se. They're much more specific than binding questions of how two molecules bind together or something of that sort. And so you're hiding, in some sense, some of the things that really are carrying the information in simpler automata. Now, what we see with these simple automata is, one, they're not good for anything but reproduction, and we can perhaps find some living forms that we might think are not good for anything but reproduction, most of them do have some other function in nature besides that particular thing. A serious problem when you're thinking of trying to use this as a pathway into the origin of life is that the reproduction of these typically collapses with any mutation. I'm going to try to give you a little tour of the Langton automaton, show how it normally works, and then show what happens if you make a small mutation in it and typically collapses. And a third very serious problem which you begin to see as you mess around with these things is that a viable automaton has to be able to reproduce while changing. That is, the mutation can't collapse its ability to reproduce, and because then you just get mutants that are unable to are sterile and unable to do anything there. The upshot of trying to make the thing more flexible is that you need to add more chip states, and that increases the complexity. Well, all of that then raises the question of whether you're really mimicking what's likely to be happening out in the biological world with this particular thing. You are doing something about what is the minimal complexity necessary to reproduce, but you're doing it in a two-dimensional environment. Two-dimensional environments are very different than three-dimensional environments. Things happen much more likely in two-dimensional environments and such. And you're doing something that's very unstable. A number of people then have been saying, well, hey, all of these, the background, the nature of the chips, etc., was designed for reproduction. Designed for reproduction doesn't sound like a universe with no designer. Can we imagine an environment or construct an environment that isn't designed for reproduction and then ask, how complicated would a thing need to be that operates in that? Some of you have probably seen John Conway's little program called Life. It was a kind of common computer game back in the DOS era anyway. I've long been overwhelmed by the rise of technology and such. But John Conway had a thing in which each space in your in say a regular written file would be either a light or a dark, and with a set of rules on how they how you change from one to the other, and so you could do a lot of things that looked like reproduction and that sort of thing. But everything was really being done pretty well in the background underneath. He basically said, well, Conway himself said, can I design an automaton that will operate in this environment life, which I did not design, to have something that would make copies of itself? And so this thing would be much more general than the Weyl or the Langton or the Ludwig automata, and it wouldn't be tied to a substrate that was especially designed for this particular automaton. And as I say, the basis for this was this existing environment, John Conway's Life, where you had these rules for what happened to a dark space when it was surrounded by a certain number of light spaces or vice versa, and which way they switched on or off or that sort of thing. Well, so he did that. But what you wind up with is an outrageously complex automaton, very much like that of von Neumann again. So you're back to a situation in which it's not something that's going to happen by chance. So trying to generalize it in that particular way, at least, did not produce anything that looked at all promising. I mentioned a little earlier the problem of fragility, that all of these automata run in an empty environment. But living things aren't in an empty environment. And even the first living thing would only have been an empty environment in the sense that none of the other stuff around it was living. But hey, we have dangers from lots of stuff that's not living. And so would it as well. So the question is, what happens when one of these automata contacts another object in its space? Well, I've done a fair bit of work with the Langton automaton on that, and I'll show you some of those on my computer program here in just a little bit. The upshot of that, as we will see, is these things are too fragile to function in a space of that sort. And so again, if you're talking about anything viable for the origin of life or something of that sort, you're going to need to solve this problem in some way as well. We try and summarize our findings then on cellular automata. We can say, first of all, that the universal constructors, the kind of automata that will make any other kind of automaton, are far too complex. That's the kind that von Neumann and Todd had designed. That the special constructors that just make themselves are far too specialized to mutate, and they seem to be too fragile. And so what you need to do is to build automata that are generalized enough to be flexible, that they're robust, slight mutations won't completely crash the thing, or at least some slight mutations won't crash the thing, and they need to be not too complex to form randomly. And as best I can tell at this point, but further research is needed, this is probably impossible. So by impossible, I do not mean 1 over 10 to the infinity. I mean 1 over 10 to the 80 certainly is going to carry you out of the range, since you've only got 10 to the 80 elementary particles in the universe, and probably even 1 over 10 to the 50 is unlikely. Dawkins, in his Blind Watchmaker, wanted to argue that if there were one chance in 10 to the 20 of forming life on a planet, then we ought to opt for that solution because he thought there were 10 to the 20 planets where you would have the right kind of conditions. I think Hugh Ross has made that unlikely in his tour of the literature. You'll find that in The Creator and the Cosmos. But that is where things stand at the moment. We try to pull all this together before we do our demonstrations here. So far, the Artificial Life Project resembles the Biological Origin of Life Project. How's that? Both have produced a few minor results that have been hyped far out of proportion to their significance. You know, you still hear about the Miller-Urey experiment 40 years after it's been done, but there hadn't been a lot more done that actually has generated. In other words, there was kind of a hope that that if you could run some more experiments longer than that, that you'd begin to generate some of these things getting together and such. And yeah, they do get together, they form tar, but getting together to form some kind of functional thing has not happened. And the Langton automaton, I think, got hyped somewhat like that. The little environment of automata that John Ray has invented called Tierra is something I think that has been hyped rather well, rather considerably as well. We didn't have time to investigate that here in this particular talk. Part of what is going on is this, the funding problem. Researchers in artificial life, researchers in biological origin of life realize you aren't going to get funding if the funders don't think there's some chance you'll succeed. And so you've got to make a presentation that emphasizes the positive in order to get the dough. And that's what's going on. I think that we have something here that can be helpful for Christians. Christians need to realize that that God will use research like that to help people see where reality actually is. We are certainly concerned about the moral climate in our country presently, but from one perspective, the moral climate in our country is a spinoff of what we might call secular humanism, and God may let it go far enough to see what that produces, to show what that produces. He knows what it produces, but to show what that produces. And I think that's part of what we see going on in this area as well. Okay, I'm going to unhook this particular computer and hook up my old junker that's got the programs on it and see if we can get some pictures out of that. Let's look at the outputs from the Langton and Beil and Ludwig automatons. I set up so they would be printed out in such a way they can be displayed on WordPerfect files. So I go into bridge out those. And I think it's showing us the wrong part of the page. Let me see if we can chop that down a little bit. Still not sure we got the right stuff. Let's see what we got here. Okay. Let's start with a simple one. That's the Ludwig automaton. And over here, I haven't got there. Are. Bring that up. Okay, let's see what's going to happen here. If this is going to work right. Okay, that's the time step one, time step two, three, four. And we've already got the new one on top in its second step already. Go back a step. There's what it is. The 2, 2, 1, and 2 is the old one turned 90 degrees, and the 6, 3, 6, 6 is one that's still a couple of steps away from being the new one. And there it's, now it's the new one, okay? And so it will begin now to multiply below itself, and the other one's multiplying to the right, and it keeps on doing that until it runs out of space. And you can see what's going on there. That's the Ludwig automaton. Okay, let's go look at the Beil automaton. Let's see what I'm going to do here to find it. There's the Beil automaton. And we start running that one. And it kind of just mumbles around there, but the 6643 in there is rotating around and telling other chips to do things. And it gradually is assembling another one to the right-hand side there, but it's got a ways to go yet. It's got to get about 25 to get there. There it is. Okay, that's the new one now on the right-hand side, and the old one is turned around one 90-degree angle with a couple extra pieces of junk down here that'll disappear in the next two steps. And so now the left-hand one is going to reproduce above, and the right one is going to reproduce to the right, and that's going to go on for a while like that. Whatever. says. Okay, come back over here, see what we're doing. Let's go down and look at the Langton one, operating under normal constraints, a more complicated automaton, but one that you get a better feeling for what it's doing. There it is, okay? Set down here in the lower left-hand corner, and at time zero. Now, the information is circulating around this little loop inside the twos there, and the first seven is now sending one copy of it will continue on around, so the loop will keep going around, but a copy is branching out this line, and so you're going to see sevens coming down that line, and as each one hits the end of the thing, it will knock the end out, and then extend one. Okay, and finally it's extended six, and now the fours are about to show up down there. What are they going to do? Well, the first four is going to produce a three. That doesn't sound like that's too impressive, okay? But then this 4-3 combination is going to make a left turn. Now the sevens show up again, and they extend that six. Okay, the complexity of this is all hidden in the transition rules, which tell for each of these cells, given these neighbors, what do you turn into in your next step? Okay, and twos are kind of the most stable things, as we will see when we start mutating this thing. But we've done our extensions now, and we're starting around the second left-hand turn, coming across, and then we're going to turn to the right here, and start coming down. Now, what's going to happen when that collides with the other? Well, then you're going to see some of the other numbers. There's a three. It's only the second time we've seen a three, and now the piece breaks through at that point, and it's going to spawn a five and a six. Boom, right there, okay? And the six is going to go over and knock the end out of the right-hand automaton and make a arm over there. And the five is going to climb up the closest two side of this old automaton and make an arm on that. And it's also going to split the two apart right here. It splits apart, okay? And now the five starts up the one side, and the six is going out the middle on the other side. And when the six gets there, it starts to extend the thing. And when the five gets up there, it starts to extend up there. And now as you're getting up, you have... this automaton on the left is already just about ready to go, and the right-hand one is still getting set up, but has got most of its arm built, and now it's extending the arm. And that will go on, and I didn't run this indefinitely. You know, that's where I quit. So there we are. But you can see what that's doing. With a bigger computer, you can run that, and you find out that once the old one gets crowded, it's got all the stuff around it that kills it, just kind of like the urban areas that get crowded out become slums or something of that sort. But we'll not carry that off further into the possible complications there. Okay, let's see. We need to... I don't want to do that. Forget that. We'll do that. Okay. No. And I want to get in there. Now, let's look at a mutation to the Langton automaton. This thing down here right under Langton called Pimple 3 is a pimple on the skin of the Langton automaton, and it happens to be a three pimple. And I've tried a hundred or so of these different things, but there's the same automaton, but no, it's got a little pimple sticking up there, that number three right on the top of the picture. What's that do? Well, here we go. Boom. One, it punches a hole in the side of the thing. That hole now begins to mess up the chain of information coming around. And so that whole interior begins to degrade. Meanwhile, everything's working okay down here. It doesn't know that the thing has collapsed behind it. But in fact, it didn't even get, it's messed things up enough now that the turn signals aren't even going to make it down there. And so it's going to run out of steam when that last thing goes out of it there. And finally, that's it. It quits. So there's the dead shell of the automaton after only 31 time steps. Let's try a barrier. Where's barrier two down here? This one we're going to put a rock in the way of the after it gets into the left turn side, so you can see what's going on there, huh? So this thing will work all right. The rock kind of degrades some and loses the inside, but the two shell stays hard, and so this stuff comes on over and starts to turn, and eventually it's going to run into the thing. What happens? Boom. Well, it begins then to mess up the signal. Everything else is working okay, but look how the thing is collapsing now here on the front end. And that's going to keep collapsing backwards until it finally gets into the main loop. It'll take longer to mess things up, but they're getting messed up now. And by the time you get to 100, you're just about gone. Boom, there it is. I think that's stable after that point. That gives you a little bit of an idea what you're doing there. Okay, that's our tour of that particular program. Let me back out of that. Let's see what I need to do. I need to answer that question, no, and answer that question, yes, and come back there. Over here in Quick Basic, I've got some examples of some computer programs that test randomness and meaning. Let's see what we got here. I need to go up and open a program as we need to do. How do we do that? There we go. Okay. In Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker, he says that people have compared the formation of life to monkeys typing Shakespeare on a computer. And he says, that's not likely if you do it their way, but if you do it my way, he says, I can show you how it's really likely. And so he has a whole bunch of monkeys with typewriters, and he's got the target phrase out of Hamlet, methinks it is like a weasel. Hamlet and somebody are looking at clouds in the sky. And so he says, you let all the monkeys type one character per page until one of them types an M as the first character on the page. Then you stop them, and you take that sheet out, and you Xerox 100 copies. So you've got 100 monkeys out there. And then you put it back in, and you let them type the next letter and see if anybody types an E. If he does, you take that paper out, you Xerox that, and you put that in all the typewriters and place the other one, and see if he types a T, anybody types a T, etc. And by every step taking the paper out and making hundreds of Xeroxes, he is then able to get the thing typed faster. Well, what he's trying to show you is that if you've got a favorable mutation, then that will eventually out-reproduce the competitors, and so then you'll eventually have all of those, and then you do a mutation in those. He doesn't say a thing about what kind of time that might take, but that's the basic thing he's going to do. Well, let's go down here and look at these two programs I call Shake H and Shake S down here, and see what we're doing with that. I think we can take this down here and just call up one of those. I'm going to do this one first, because this is most like, except I'm having trouble looking at the screen and running my machinery at the same time. There we go. And I get into the OK and find my way around. I need to just look at what I'm doing over here, but I don't have it on the screen. There we go. Okay. This is a program selecting random changes to move a sequence of gibberish to eventually conform to a given target phrase or sentence intended to mimic the program disguised by Richard Dawkins in The Blind Watchmaker. Okay, so we want to run that. So let me go find my way up to run here. What happened? Didn't believe me or something. Okay, run number one. Date. This stuff is mostly junk, but it was for record keeping purposes. Okay, target sequence. Okay. Somebody in the audience, we may have to make some choices on this. Give me a very short sentence, kind of like me thinks it is like a weasel, that kind of length, but you don't need to do that one. Jesus wept. Okay. Okay, did I spell it right? Yes. Well, let's do it in all caps, which we're supposed to do anyway in order not to fret the machine up. Okay, that's certainly very short, okay? Target sentence. Okay, initial gibberish, same length, and can it consist of either caps or space? I'll let different members of the audience call out a letter. Okay, who would like to call out a letter? Q? B. Let's put a space in there. Okay, who'd like to call out another letter? R. D. Did I hit the D? No, didn't hit the D. Didn't hit the D yet. Hard with a screen there and here. This doesn't have a lit screen on this one. I can't do that. Okay, another letter? F? Or was that S? We'll put an S into. Okay? And we'll put a space there, and we need two more letters. M. X. Okay, there we are. Okay. We're now ready to go. We've got the target sequence, and we've got the initial sequence, same length, but totally different sets of letters. Okay. We hit the return, and we need a random number seed, a number between -32768. Oh, I'm supposed to be writing all this stuff down because we're going to run the same program on a different program here in a minute. Okay, we got Jesus wept, space WPT, and we've got QB space, and we've got RDFS, and we've got a space, and we've got MX. Okay, somebody give me a number for the random number seed. 42. Okay. 42. And I gotta break that down here too. R and S. 42. Okay, now we're gonna run. Boom. Okay, it hasn't made it by 100 yet. Okay, so should I continue? Yes, certainly. And I think I have to hit that to make it continue. Okay, and it's somewhere between 100 and 200. It managed to find its way to the right place. Okay, now I'm going to back out of this program. I've got that stored on output, and we're going to go look at the output in a minute. I'm going to back out of this program and go try the other program with exactly the same setup. So we need to get into File, and Open Program, and go down here, and it was Shape H we did, so it's Shape F we want to get into. I'm trying to find out how to get over here with OK. Getting better at this after a while. And we're now going to run this program. Okay, run number 2. 30 January. Got the cat going now, so I shouldn't make that space there. 399. Target sequence. Other sequence. I gotta read it from here. QB space R RDFS space MX random number seed 42. Okay, and we run that. Okay, hasn't done anything by 100 yet. I hadn't gotten there by 100 yet. Hadn't gotten there by 200 yet. Hadn't gotten there by 300 yet. Hasn't gotten there by 400 yet. Hadn't gotten there by 500 yet? 600? 700? Why is this taking so long? We'll see in a second. Okay, it got there between 800 and 900 somewhere. Okay, press any key to continue, and we get out of this whole program and go over to our word processor program to look at this stuff. And we go there, and we go to exit. And go to our word processor program. Then we pull up the thing there, and we've got to go over to where our other stuff is, which is 7CQD45, and turn that on. And didn't like that. I didn't hit it again. Something happened. There it is. And we've got to find Shape Out and Shape H Out. Okay, they're both down below that page, so get a good page down. And then page down again, and here they are. Shape out is over here. That's the second one we did, and Shape H is the first one. We'll go look at the first one. The one we did first, which is the Shape H out. And get over there. And we just do it this way. What happened? It's wrong. Hit the right key. Okay, here we are. Computer simulation. And the difference here is multiple mutations. This one has one mutation in each position, each generation. Okay? So, run number 1, etc. Target, Jesus wept, initial sequence, etc. Here's the initial. Time 0. That's the initial sequence. And there's a calculation done to figure out how far away it is from the target. And won't get into how you do that, but it's 165 units away. Notice the mutations that take place in that first step. The blank becomes an H, the R becomes a W, the F becomes an E, the blank becomes an A, the others don't change. But it jumps about half the way to its target, first step, okay? And it will keep doing that. So you can see it's going to get there fairly quickly by that technique. We'll run on down the page here, see what we can see. We need to go down to the same page. It's going to close in pretty fast. Every step, it's closer to the thing, because in fact the program is testing whether this value is closer after the mutation or not, and if it is, it moves it on further. It takes that as a new thing to mutate on. So it's going to close in pretty fast, but even so, it takes over 100 to get down there. You see, we've got Jesus now already, and we've actually got Jesus West already, but we haven't got that blank in there yet. No, not likely to do that, okay? And in fact, it stays a long time there because it has, finally, down to the last step, you have to get the right mutation in the right place. And as it happens, the way this thing calculates distance, A is the closest letter to a blank, that's using ASCII numbers, I believe. So it's gonna sit around for a long time, not being able to get down, better than that. And then finally gets there, it'll jump to zero, right? That shot, unless it, because I really didn't give it any other alternative to work with, and so there it goes. Took 122 steps to get there. That is the kind of thing Dawkins is doing in his book. It converges very quickly because he's doing mutations on kind of all the stuff. And once you get the right letter in a place, he won't let it change, okay? And now whether that's the way mutations really work in nature is quite another matter. Now let's back out of this one then and go look at the output from the other one. This is shakeout, so we've got to go down the page and go find it. There it is up there. One more. And pull that up. Okay, here it is, run number two. Notice the title's a little different. It does make multiple mutations because it's one mutation at a generation, okay? And this is more like what Dawkins would be talking about. You take the sheep out of the thing after they got the right letter, etc. And so you start out the same distance away, 165, but it takes a couple of mutations before you can actually get anything better. At 164, you've got the R changes to a W, and a W is closer apparently in that space, G-E-S-U-S. Yeah, I'm not sure, it kind of looks to me like it's both the same. So it's now moving downward, finally gets rid of one of the spaces at 8, and moves on in that direction. Let me get down there so we can run on. But remember, this one takes 800 and some to get down there. It's gotten down to the 50s already, two-thirds of the way there, but the changes get harder to do as you get closer on. Suggests that in mutation, fine-tuning gets harder and harder to do. Okay? Something rough might not be too hard, but fine-tuning. And so we're going to run on through pages of this. Whoop, there was a really good change there somewhere. Jumped from 48 to 12. What happened? It got a space in the right place, okay? It's now got both words the right length. Okay, and it'll keep that the rest of the way. Now it's got to get the right letters in the right words, which you can see haven't done too much on. You've got an E in the right place, and that's it at that point. And that's already at 100 and something. But now we've got to get the right letters, so we run on for a while. We finally pick up a J out here. It dropped it down, and we've got a U, a switch from a W to a V to a U here for the a U in Jesus. We still haven't done much anything on the back one. And of course, it's randomly on which. Now we've got a W for the beginning of the whip and such. But we're only 200 and something. This thing's going to take over 800 shots to close in on that. Pick up an S and a W-E. Now we're down to two. We've got haven't got the last word of Jesus, and we haven't got the P in the wet, but we've got Q. We've got the nearest letter. We've got the nearest letter in both cases. So we're only two off. We're one position off in each one. And that will go on for a while. It switches to one finally at 600 and something. And to get that last one, it's going to take over 200. It finally does. 873. Get a little idea of that. Okay, that's enough messing around with that stuff tonight, but today. We'll go back to there and turn our machinery off. Okay, I'm ready to field some questions, or if we can quit or whatever. There we are.
Okay, at this time what we want to do is give Dr. Newman a minute to get a drink of water and give you all a chance, if you didn't already pass in those forms, to pass them in. and stretch your legs maybe, and then we'll start the questions in a couple of minutes here.
10 to the 80, I've encountered them. that's a typical estimate you see floating around the literature for 20 to 30 years. Yeah. Oh, no. We're talking elementary particles would be protons, neutrons, electrons, et cetera, not dealing. And then if they're clustered together, I think they're still counted separately as protons, neutrons, electrons. So you're trying to make an estimate of total number of atoms in the universe, and then working with some frequency table of what kind they are, you can split those out into, uranium-235 has got, I hate to even say, I think it's 92 protons, and the rest are neutrons, and you've got 92 electrons, so that counts at 235 plus 92 elementary particles. So that's what you're doing, yeah. Yeah, here. Yeah, in that program, you have a randomness thing that says, picks a number between 0 and 1, and then we convert that into the length of the line and say, okay, that's the spot we're going to do it in. Then we do another pick between 0 and 1, and we look at that with the 27 characters we've got to operate. This is the character we're going to put there. Then we put it in. Then we compare the new one and the old ones with how close they are to the target. And if the new one is closer to the target, we replace the old one with that, and if it's further from the target, we leave the old one alone. So that's the technique we use there. And the difference from that and the old other program is it does a mutation on every spot and then tests them, and then tests the result, I think. I'd have to check now how the program put together. It's been several years since I looked at the contents of that program, but does something like that. I don't remember now whether it makes a bunch of samples and tries them all and picks the best one or which it does there, but it does a mutation on every location. So, if you ask yourself in nature which of the two is going on, if you're getting two or three mutations in different locations, you're probably going to crash the whole thing. You really are talking single mutations in very, you do get places where a whole piece of DNA is turned out and turned around and hooked back in or something. But we're working on point mutations for this sort of thing. And it does not close nearly as fast as Dawkins would give you to believe. And then we stop and ask, what's the step of taking the paper out and Xeroxing however many copies you need? That is actually the spread of that mutation through the whole population. And you've got to have a pretty significant difference in viability to spread that rapidly at all. So you are hiding an awful lot of time in that particular. Good question.
I think we'll have to understand on the molecular level of chemistry allow things to come together to form programs, just because it seems like all the K constants go way downhill, and to somehow even talk about a prebiotic soup that's forming things, isn't there a probability of that being totally against it?
Yeah. The work that you see in Faxon, Bradley, and Olson's book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, or the work that you see in Robert Shapiro's book, Origins, A Skeptic's Guide to Creation of Life on Earth, both get into the numbers on that, and they're pretty disastrous. This work, I understand, I have not seen it now, other than the cover, by Hubert Yockey on information theory and Origin of Life, I'm not sure that's how the title ends, but I think from Cambridge, deals with the same kind of question. Enormously low there. Now, interesting thing is that once you get up where you've got DNA, the relative units in DNA, four different, pyrimidines or something, those can equally well fit in any space, except they then always grab their alternate pair, the opposite thing, to link into them. So they're a real information system. See, a real information system, if you've got too much resistance to changing something, you don't have information, right? And at that point, you've got a real information system, and they're hoping that somehow you can jigger your way into that by a series of random mutations. Miller, your experiments have been very poor, though, on making the base pair type stuff that you need for the DNA as well. So the big problems there I haven't dealt with here. I'm basically trying to back out and say, how much information do you need to make a reproducer? And the answer is, well, if you can hide a lot of it in the substrate, then you can get by with less of it in the other. And so the game of life has got none in the in what's got one unit of information. It's got a dark square or a light square in the visible stuff, and then all the other stuff is down in the rules, which are fairly simple rules. But that's typical of most of these programs. I think the Langton thing had something like 179 transition rules or something like a big number. And even the simple ones, bile and such, have got a dozen or so transition rules in them that that are hiding some information. That in biology, we don't think the soup will do that. You could argue some of it will be done in the way molecules fit together, but that's very hard to model because of, you know, once you start getting these folded up three-dimensional proteins, you're getting out of the hand of what we can visualize very well, and whether computers will help us with that, 50 years up the line, enough to be able to visualize some of that better. I don't know. I mean, you're already being able to make images and such. Yeah, good. Good again. Question here. Yeah.
The twos in the program, they're a protective thing about.
Okay. Yeah, they're chosen so that their transition rules make them very stable. Okay. So that way they protect. And you can see, when you put a little pimple on the thing that punched a hole in the twos, suddenly all the information inside starts getting killed.
It's a semi-permeable membrane.
Yeah, that's basically right. The original idea that I think either Cott or Langton had was I'm trying to mimic something about nerve cells, where they've got a sheath that protects the information running down it. That might even have been back at von Neumann's thought in that direction, but somewhere that idea got in, and so they've been using that for all of them. It kind of evaporates in the Bile and Ludwig automatons, but very obvious in the Langton one and some of the earlier ones.
Do some of those, maybe a Langton or maybe something a little more complex, will it do a cinnamon roll pattern?
Will it do a
viral pattern? Do some of them do?
Oh, you can make them do any of these things. In other words, what? Where all the work really is, there's a little bit of work in the geometry, but Langton having seen that Codd had in his design these little loops to produce a periodic signal coming out at the end of the pipe, he just said, well, what changes could I make in that so that one of the periodic signals would lengthen the length of the pipe, and one of the signals would make the pipe turn back on itself, and then the big trick was, how do I get the thing to unhook from its mother? And then make two new arms. And all of that stuff is hidden very abstractly in, given that this number is the number in this, in the middle cell. I mean, you look at each cell in turn, the computer program does, looks at each cell in turn and asks what its neighbors are, and then that gives it a rule for what its own number is going to be at the next time step. And so by jiggering all of those things, you can finally get it to do this kind of stuff. But, what's going on? A lot of intelligence is going on there to organize that. Okay.
It does sort of make a baby never reattach.
It doesn't reattach. They get killed by crowding. Since they can't move, they get killed by crowding. So once the mother has made a daughter on all four sides, when it comes around to make it on the fifth side, that's back where the other one was, and as soon as it puts out an arm, that kills itself, and it just sits there quiet. So it's a little bit more like coral, building a coral reef or something. Once you've crowded yourself out, you're dead, and such. So that's kind of what you're doing there. Yeah. Yes, sir.
It seems as with all this data and the impossibilities of these putting together, that why do such bright scientists persist in believing the impossible thing of spontaneous generation, that dead chemistry can produce life? Just, we were ridiculed by that long ago, and yet there is a constant. The whole scientific community refusing somehow to even look for a designer, let alone, not talking about the God of the Bible necessarily, but they just refuse to say there's design.
There's some interest in scientists in recent years on the question of design. So if you look around, it shows up some in the scientific literature, usually with scorn, and in the evangelical literature with some encouragement of what we call an intelligent design movement. That is basically trying to say, okay, we're not going to, at this point, deal with the question of who the intelligent designer might be. Isn't there indeed some evidence of a designer out there? And can you test the question of the existence of a designer by scientific method? And some scientists will immediately say, no, you can't. But then you're going to say, well, let's see. Are you using scientific methods
when you try and find out whether you're receiving an extraterrestrial message by radio signals, and how would you detect it? And moving into a little bit more mundane field, you're an archaeologist, and you see all this chipped rock lying in the bed of a stream. How do you tell which of that chipped rock has been intelligently chipped and which of it has been chipped by just banging against other pieces of stone as it worked its way down from the mountain? And the answer is going to have to be something about information, something about symmetry maybe, or evidence of a previous symmetry that's gotten messed up because a point got chipped off or the side got chipped off of an arrowhead or something. How do you recognize an arrowhead from a chipped stone? And the boundaries are tricky. So there's a lot of argument about the very earliest chipped stones, whether they show intelligence or whether not, okay? But when you get up to what we, I guess we'd even call, I'm going to block myself up there, we'll say middle stone age anyway. I think you can probably even get an old stone age. You get some pretty impressive stuff that did that the, what should we say, the probabilistic resources of the universe aren't going to generate, okay? But somebody who's trying to make a pointed arrowhead with a notch that'll be able to be tied to a thing, it's very recognizable, et cetera. So you're into that thing? And the point's been made by the intelligent design movement that looking for extraterrestrial messages, haven't found it yet, but and may not, but they still have developed a paradigm, algorithm for how you'd go about recognizing that. In archaeologists recognizing whether something's an artifact or not, researchers in forensic work trying to recognize whether a crime has been committed or whether it's merely an accident of some sort, how the person died, heart attack, bullet wound, poison, etc. Is he likely to have come across that kind of poison in the environment, or is that something that shows evidence of chemistry, a chemical laboratory somewhere, and such, those kind of things. The nicest discussion of that available at the moment is pretty expensive, though I think you can find short versions of it, is William Dembski's book, The Design Inference, published this fall by Cambridge University Press. A short version of it is in the book that came out about a month later from InterVarsity called Near Creation. Dembski is the editor of that, and he and a couple of his colleagues that were involved in that did that. This talk I gave you is one of the chapters in that, basically. It's the last chapter, and that is the last chapter before you get into summarizations or something of that sort. There is some interesting stuff going on there. You're right that there is a strong bias, at least in the official scientific community, the guys that run the journals and such, that somehow talking about intelligent design is sneaking theism, and that's not kosher. If you really ask the question why it's not kosher, you're not going to get a very good answer. If science is truth-seeking, as opposed to playing word games, then it's kosher, though in fact it might not turn out to find anything, okay? But it looks like we're finding stuff already. That's the point. And if we really are finding stuff, then I think you have to say that's the direction in which progress is going to be made on origin universe, origin life, etc. And they say, well, what can you say except that God did it? Well, you might be able to say a great deal besides just God did it. And you might be able to finally say something about whether there's evidence that that all of the diversity of living things is programmed into the first living thing, or that that information had to be inserted at various times in the history of life by looking at what's there, particularly if you think you can recover any DNA far enough back and beginning to fiddle with that a little bit. And don't know where that will go. So I get lost on what your question was after I've wandered on that far, but did we catch most of it? Yeah. It's one of the manifestations of humanity's unwillingness to face our own responsibility for God. And of course, it's got millions of different kinds of manifestations in our society and among believers and such as well. But this is one of them, and I think you see it here. You see it a paradigm of it probably in the first verses of Psalm 2. The kings of the earth and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his Messiah. Let us break their chains and cast off their bonds. The lifestyle that God and his Messiah wants to restrict it from these people. And so they want to go some other way. Yeah, good question.
The creation of artificial life and other research into autonomy, is that valuable at this point beyond what has already been discovered? Can that help us understand life or anything?
It might.
it might. Obviously, when you get into the question of funding scientific research, there is a wide variety of opinion in society. Okay? And yet, I think most everybody, at least in our society, recognizes that funding basic research can produce results you never expected, and at least a lot of them are good. Perhaps all of them are good in some sense, except that humans aren't good. And so new knowledge quite typically gets turned both in bad directions and in good directions as well. So you've got that. I mean, you can see in many ways how our technology is really improves life in certain ways, and yet we'll be in more trouble if our technology crashes for some reason. That we've now got a population way above what subsistence farming could support, for instance. And that's the kind of thing people are worried about in the Y2K. Is suppose all this caves in. I don't have 100 acres, and I don't have all this corn or wheat or something stored in my barns and such, and all that stuff in my freezer. If the electricity goes off for 6 weeks in the week, I'm either going to have to eat pretty heavy then and pretty thin thereafter, or something. And so you can see some of that working there. Of course, World War II, I mean, hey, the 20th century has shown us some of the misuses of technology as well. I don't have a good verbal memory, so once I get started talking, I forget where I started from and get lost, but sorry.
My son in school, when they had this discussion about evolution, and one of the arguments they always use, which they continually bring up, and it clearly doesn't, is that, say, the ape only differs from a human DNA by, 1 or 2%. And they use that as an argument to show that they're so similar that only small little changes. How do you answer that?
Yeah, well, probably one thing is that's slightly misleading. And the way to find that out is ask if any of these guys who think it's only 1 or 2% different are willing to have a blood transfusion from a chimp. But immediately begin to think that there's some problem there. I mean, it's even dangerous to have some blood transfusion from other humans because of changes in that particular direction. What I'm inclined to say is that God used the model or the basic body plan that he had used for apes and chimps, etc., to make humans out of that kind of a body plan. I do not believe that God remodeled an ape, etc., as some of the theistic evolutionists do. I think he started from scratch. But he used what we might say off-the-shelf components, to use EE-type terminology. And there are obviously some huge differences between apes and chimps and humans, and we don't see those primarily in the anatomy, although there's some significant anatomical differences. We see those primarily in what we would call the spiritual and mental realms, and the languaging abilities, the abstracting abilities, and that sort of thing. And it's not that the apes have none of that, but they're way down the line, they don't seem to be all that different from the cats and dogs and that sort of thing in those abilities. And it looks like there's a big chasm between those. Francis Schaeffer years ago suggested that there are two chasms in created reality. One is between God and all his created beings, and we're creatures, and we share that with all the other beings on earth, etc. And God's the creator. But there's another chasm in which we are more like God and the others are less like us, and that's the chasm of, I think he said, image of God or personality or something of that sort. I don't remember the exact terminology he used now. And I think you really see that it appears that humans have a whole class of abilities there that we don't see intermediates of. Obviously, the evolutionists would say, well, we don't see the intermediates of because humans killed off all the intermediates. And I can believe that, a fallen man, okay. But we would need some more evidence in that particular direction. Question back here, Doc.